The system of rules, laws, and determination of responsibility or guilt are assumed to have two elements firmly connected with them, fairness as well as an adherence to the Constitution. Back in 2011, the Obama administration pushed those concepts to the side and instead enabled colleges in America to very liberally and even unconstitutionally redefine the right to free speech and what constitutes harassment. Recently, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos led observers to believe that some of these invasions of rights and liberal definition of acts would be eliminated. It would explain the foundation which was laid, which the Trump administration is now seeking to repair as a senior attorney with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, as well as member of the Regulatory Transparency Project, Hans Bader. Thanks for being here today, sir.
Thank you.
And to website, CEI.org, and for Regulatory Transparency Project, RegProject.org. Learn more about two points of focus, or the many points of focus those two organizations do have. So just for a foundation of the conversation, it's referred to as the Dear Colleague Letter back from April of 2011. What was the change in the ways that certain issues were addressed created by that Dear Colleague Letter from the Obama administration?
Well, it did a number of things. It told colleges to lower the standard of proof they needed for convicting students for harassment or sexual assault. It told them they needed to regulate off-campus conduct rather than leaving that be investigated by the police. It told them that they should not allow accused people to cross-examine their accusers, even though there are state administrative procedure laws that protect that. And also the Supreme Court has said that cross-examination is the greatest engine for the discovery of the truth that's ever been invented. And they told colleges that they had to follow a whole bunch of rules regarding their processes, like processing complaints very quickly, which can lead to miscarriages of justice. And they also told them that you couldn't allow the accused to appeal unless you have the accuser allowed to cross-appeal, which is a disincentive to allow people to challenge findings of guilt, that some civil libertarians, like the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, thought created a sort of double jeopardy. So all of these new mandates were issued in a letter rather than going through the regulation rulemaking process that's commanded by the Federal Administrative Procedure Act. So they didn't seek anybody's input before this letter. They didn't go through notice and comment. They didn't put this letter in the Code of Federal Regulations where anybody could see it other than the school officials who received this letter. And then colleges across the country had to change longstanding policies to comply with this letter at the risk of losing all of their federal funds. So many did, in fact, change their policies, some under protest, and some despite the fact that their own university general counsel told them that the education department's position was not well-grounded in law because nobody wants to bet the farm on whether they can take on the combined resources of the federal government.
So, in effect, that Dear Colleague Letter was parallel to a president doing an executive order. The only difference is the letter came from the Department of the Office of for Civil Rights, which isn't even doesn't even have an elected member. They're all strictly political appointees. So it's basically an executive order allowing colleges to become sovereign nations of their own within a sovereign nation running counter laws.
Well, I mean, they in a way, they undercut the the sovereignty of states because they told universities they were not supposed to follow state law on things like whether an accused could cross-examine their accuser. So to me, I would look at it, not only did they tell universities to do things they weren't necessarily very well positioned to do, which I think is your point. You know, they're basically telling colleges you need to investigate off-campus conduct, like off-campus sexual assaults, even though you would think a logical person would want that reported to the police, and the police would have access to all the witnesses and the setting in which it occurred, whereas it might be far away from a campus, and a campus might not have the ability to, you know, acquire all the relevant evidence to make a fair finding. They not only did that, but they also essentially forced colleges to ignore long-standing protections contained in state administrative procedure acts. So they went to both extremes in the very same letter.
Now, the assumption by someone who's maybe just hearing about this idea for the first time after all these years even is that this would allow someone to more easily accuse a case of sexual harassment, where, in fact, can it make it more difficult for a victim of sexual harassment to prove their point?
Well, this letter itself didn't really cause that much harm to victims. But there were other things the Education Department did under Obama later on that did harm victims. For example, in the University of Virginia, they told the University of Virginia, you have to keep investigating even if the complainant doesn't want you to keep investigating, which could re-traumatize the victim, because if you know the accused is guilty, why can't you just stop the investigation and expel them then? And they also told the University of Virginia that they had to investigate even when the complainant didn't even, not complainant's the wrong word, when a student, you know, sought counseling, you know, over something that happened but didn't even want an investigation. They said you have to investigate. And, of course, people may be less likely to come forward and even talk to somebody in the counseling center or talk to, you know, some person in the dean's office if they think it's going to always lead to an investigation that they don't want. You know, this could actually disincentivize them from talking to anybody. And by doing that, it might result in fewer people getting help that they need. And also, conversely, it might lead to fewer people talking to the police about actual real-world violent crimes that you want reported to the police.
Or if nothing else, create the culture of, well, if the colleges are saying that their rule is the rule, then I don't have to talk to the police.
Right. And, of course, when a Virginia legislator proposed legislation that would require all these violent crimes to be reported to the police, the Education Department went to the head of the House of Delegates Courts of Justice Committee and convinced him that Title IX forbade that, and that Title IX could not allow the state to, mandate reporting of violent crimes to prosecutors and essentially deprive the state of the ability to make that decision about whether to do that. They claimed that it was preempted by Title IX. And, of course, if you read Title IX, it doesn't say anything about that at all. All Title IX says is that people can't be discriminated against based on sex in any, federally subsidized educational program, meaning most colleges in the country. It doesn't say anything about state laws, mandating reporting of violent crimes being preempted. To me, that's bonkers.
Yes.
I mean, that's massive federal overreaching, and states should be allowed to experiment with mandatory reporting policies to see whether that more effectively, curbs sexual assault and rape on college campuses and better protects safety. This is exactly the kind of thing you want states to be able to do, voluntarily do, and see whether it helps or hurts victims. And hopefully helps them. And then if that works, other states can try it too, and we can, calibrate the best policy we can to protect public safety on our campuses rather than having federal bureaucrats override that and essentially demand that colleges have kangaroo courts to handle these cases. But, all they can do is expel the accused, even if the accused is in fact guilty of something serious, rather than putting them in jail where it may be necessary to put them to protect public safety, given that people who forcibly commit rape, they sometimes do this over and over and over again until they're incarcerated and kept from doing so in the future. So this is very bad public policy to take away the ability of state legislatures to, legislate in the public interest and to protect public safety.
Well, Hans Bader, who is the senior attorney with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, is also a member of the Regulatory Transparency Project, CEI.org, RegProject.org, their respective websites, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. The Dear Colleague letter also, as we've referred to already, allowed colleges to go after someone for off-campus activities, which doesn't just involve actions, but it can involve words and speech as well. So, I guess hypothetically, maybe this has even happened in some cases, someone could write an article which is perceived as attacking, sexist, racist, whatever the case may be, by some individual within a college hierarchy or college body. So I guess that means the door right now is open for people to be punished for freedom of speech based upon interpretation of someone outside the law.
Right. That's what happened to Professor Laura Kipnis at Northwestern. She published an op-ed in the Chronicle of Higher Education 500 miles away from her campus talking about sexual paranoia on her campus. And students on her campus got word of this, and they then accused her of sexual harassment. And, she said it's off campus. They said it doesn't matter. See the Dear Colleague letter. And then when she complained about it on Twitter, they then accused her of retaliation. And in federal court, if you were an employer, retaliation protections are limited by common sense. in two ways. First, if you make a factually false allegation against someone and it's clear that it was false, they can still fire you because it's only a truthful or potentially truthful allegation that's protected. And then second, not everything that people do that bugs you after you complain is deemed retaliation. It has to have some tangible impact on you. And under the Obama Education Department's interpretation of Title IX, neither was the case. So the college investigated her for months and months, and they only stopped investigating her when it triggered nationwide outcry in the Wall Street Journal and the Chronicle of Higher Education and other places about this being a serious infringement on free speech and academic freedom. So pressuring colleges to restrict off-campus speech is, you know, it's very bad from an academic freedom vantage point. And for public universities and school districts, it's also bad in terms of subjecting them to cross-cutting liability from the disciplined speaker, because there are courts that have ruled that off-campus speech, even when it's vulgar and inappropriate, is just not subject to the same restrictions that it is when it's on campus. Like, you know, when you send your kid to a grade school, they can tell the kid, don't use vulgarity. But in big chunks of the country, the courts have ruled that they can't ban vulgarity off campus, like in Klein versus Smith, where a federal judge ruled that a student could use the F word about his teacher because he was off campus, away from school, even though he could easily be suspended for the same thing in school. So when the Obama Education Department told colleges and school districts, you should be regulating speech that someone thinks is bullying or sexual harassment off grounds or off campus, that leads to schools then being sued for free speech violations by the people who were saying something off campus, because the First Amendment standards are not quite the same. They're a little different at the higher education level off campus than on, and they're very different at the K-12 school level, where schools have a lot of authority to regulate speech on their grounds and much less ability to restrict speech off campus.
It's amazing when you think of, not as a majority, but a large part of Title IX was really, the origin of it was just to create equality in collegiate sports, equal funding, equal opportunity, things like that. I mean, it has its offshoots and other elements, but is a removal of this Dear Colleague policy going to be as simple as it sounds, or is it going to be challenging to reverse what's become an unconstitutional culture, in a way, in so many of these college campuses now due to this Dear Colleague letter?
I mean, the irony is people talk a lot about the Dear Colleague letter telling colleges they had to use a lower standard of proof. But even if you get rid of it, most of them will still use the lower standard of proof because they're terrified of being investigated if they don't find somebody guilty. And then that person in the future harasses someone. And they're worried not only about the Office for Civil Rights investigating them, but they're afraid of being sued in court under Title IX for money damages. They're more afraid of being sued in court under state laws that have a broader definition of harassment or hold them liable for less negligence, like New Jersey or Massachusetts or California law. And so, as a practical matter, even if they get rid of the Dear Colleague letter, most of the colleges aren't going to go back to a higher standard of proof unless, you know, their state constitution is interpreted as requiring that higher standard of proof, which it might be in a few states. I can see that argument maybe in Washington State. But it's not, you know, the federal courts have not been terribly protective of due process in campus administrative proceedings to begin with. The main thing that the Dear Colleague letter violated was some state law rights that students had. Like, you know, in a number of states, you have a state law right to cross-examination, including if the accused doesn't have an attorney, he can directly cross-examine the accuser, which is something the Dear Colleague letter says you shouldn't do in any harassment case. And I understand why people wouldn't want cross-examination in a case involving forcible rape, but I can't imagine what justification you would have for saying that in an ordinary harassment case, you can't cross-examine your accuser when you could cross-examine them in any other kind of proceeding, whether it's vandalism or theft or what have you. And there's no reason why there would be, you know, less right to do that under a state administrative procedure law in one of those types of cases than in another. So the reality is the biggest potential change of getting rid of the Dear Colleague letter would be if they openly acknowledge that it conflicted with the Bush administration and Clinton administration positions in other areas, like do they have to regulate off-campus conduct? And can they have appeal rights designed to protect the accused, you know, robust appeal rights? And, you know, can they take a reasonable amount of time to process the complaint even if the, you know, the accused is away on summer vacation or something, rather than having to meet some arbitrary 60-day timetable for deciding the case? These other much less publicized features of the Dear Colleague letter actually caused more harm than its very well-publicized demand that colleges reduce the standard of proof, given that fact that many colleges already used a pretty low standard of proof designed to, you know, insulate themselves against a lawsuit by the complainant. The short answer is I don't know how much real-world effect it'll have if they just withdraw the letter without replacing it with some clear guidance explaining why they're withdrawing it. And although it does seem very clear that the Education Department is going to withdraw aspects of that Dear Colleague letter, it's not clear to me whether they're going to get rid of all the features in that letter or whether they're even aware of all the ways that it violated state law and contradicted, you know, pre-Obama Education Department positions.
There's just one more question now. As you go college hunting for the kids, you'll have to ask what a university's adherence to the Dear Colleague law, to what level are they adhering and following it, and just adds to the adventure of college education for your child and your children. He is a senior attorney with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, member of the Regulatory Transparency Project, CEI.org, RageProject.org, their respective websites. Hans Bader, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.